Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
It's great to have you here on the Clark Howard Show. You know, our mission is to serve you with advice and information that empowers you so you can make better financial decisions in your life. Now, the job market has been through Mr. Toad's wild ride for the last 4 years. I mean, a crazy, crazy disruptive job market. And there are a lot of people who came of age at a time that you could measure your tenure at jobs in months instead of years. And I want to talk about changing jobs to get a better position, to get more pay right now, because there's a real clear shift that's going on. And also, housing costs are getting so crazy that an idea from the distant past in America is coming back in part. I'm going to tell you about a new path to affordable homes that is an old path, really. So the job market went through such distortions in 20 and 21, and really into maybe the first half of 22, that a lot of people developed a new attitude about work, and people coming of age, going into the workforce out of high school, out of trade school, or out of college, developed a new perspective on work that is not really how things operate. So I remember hearing somebody say to me, well, you know, it's not like I'm a job hopper. I've stayed at this job a year. And I was thinking how funny that is, because people used to be considered to be job hoppers if they changed jobs more frequently than every 5 years. And then during the disruptions in the economy that occurred during COVID, there came this mentality that, hey, the only way to get ahead, the only way to get more money is to switch jobs repeatedly. And so there are people who've had job after job after job, again, measured in months instead of years. And the job market is in many ways normalizing. And so being a what was always called a job hopper for obvious reasons has new meaning now. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're a job hopper if you're somewhere less than 5 years, but definitely if you're somewhere less than 2 years, we're back to that being really out of the norm. And employers will look at you as someone who probably isn't worth the risk of the expense involved in bringing you in, giving you training and how things work wherever you're going. And so you become kind of like spoiled goods as a candidate. And this is a shift because, you know, during 2021 into 22, the way people made more money was they had ants in their pants. They kept jumping from place to place to place. And the pay raises you would get for being disloyal to an employer and going somewhere else was so much greater than staying. And I kept talking about how dumb this was of employers, that their existing staff, they were doing the normal corporate, well, we grant 2.4% maximum raises, and that's all you're going to get. And then they find out they can go somewhere else and get a 17% raise. People were just changing jobs all the time. Well, now, even though we are the strongest economy in the Western world, I got to talk about that another time soon. The job market is not as intensely strong as it is with very low unemployment and all that, as it was when the velocity cycle was at its peak, where employers were constantly having to fill openings, and it created this virtuous cycle for people who kept switching jobs that is now over. And then we've got the sector rotation with a lot of tech companies laying off a lot of people. It's causing a complete rethink about the market. And so stability and loyalty are back in vogue. It doesn't mean you need to be somewhere where they're taking advantage of you. But it also means that particularly if you're in a sector that's volatile, like tech, showing some stability in a job so that you're building some time in the job and some experience, if there is, in fact, a layoff or the company goes bust or whatever, you've got some experience there on the resume before you would think about changing. And the salary gap between people who hop to a new job and people who stay has really closed. It's not like it was for those 2.5 years. So this is a time to rethink. And particularly if, as I said much earlier, you came into the workforce during this cycle, your perception of what a job is supposed to mean and how long you stay may be off base because it's what you experienced right when you came into the workforce. You think that's normal? No, that was abnormal. What we're having now, much more so.
Okay, we'll go to questions. Brian in Florida writes, would it ever make sense to trade in a newer vehicle for another make and model if it would result in a significant reduction in insurance premiums? We have 2 teen drivers.
Oh, two. One is rough enough. Two?
Yeah, 2 teen drivers. A third about to get her license. And all 4 of our current vehicles are 1 to 2 years old. I just received my Amica renewal, and I noticed that 2 of the vehicles, which are the same make and model, are about $2,000 more per year each to insure than the other 2, which are different makes. All of them are comparable in size and cost, and all are highly rated by Consumer Reports. I normally keep my vehicles 10 to 15 years, but if I'm able to save $4,000 per year on insurance, it seems the insurance cost savings might far outweigh the hit we would take on trading them in.
Yeah, so this is an interesting thing, Brian. Cars have driving histories too. And so certain makes and models have a historical profile that the drivers of them are much more likely to be in accidents, particularly accidents that cause injuries. So if you have a couple of models that have this mark of shame from the insurance industry, what you're thinking, Brian, makes sense that you would potentially save over the years quite a bit of money with 2, soon to be 3 teenage drivers, if you think in terms of what vehicles are cheapest to insure. And don't automatically assume, you know, you contact Amica and say, okay, so these are so expensive. What does it cost to insure this kind of vehicle or that kind or the other kind? So you would know which ones to target that you would be comfortable owning that would be far cheaper to insure. And there are certain models that have this kind of mark of shame. I remember years ago, my wife drove a car that was the most expensive. It doesn't exist as a model anymore, but it was the most expensive model to insure because it was in so many accidents. It was called, you'd have to go back in the Wayback Machine of cars. It was called a Ford Probe. And for some reason, Probe drivers were always looking for a way to get into an accident. Mm. And so the insurance for that was so expensive. And my wife, when she sold the Probe and bought something else, saved so much money on her insurance.
Okay, Stephanie in Indiana says, what, do you want me to name this company?
Sure.
What do you think of the Robinhood Gold membership? Is $5 a month worth it?
The $60 a year is not a lot. If you're happy using Robinhood and you use the services that come with gold, go ahead. Robinhood is a company you don't hear me say nice things about. Robinhood has had a lot of operational difficulties. They've done a lot of U-turns. There was a time they weren't properly executing trades. And recently, when they came out with the new 3% cashback card that you have to be a gold member to have, I didn't exactly do cartwheels about this incredible 3% cashback because I'm not excited by Robinhood. But there are many people who use Robinhood who are very happy with it. If you are, and you're pleased with the services you've gotten, Stephanie, you're happy with the cost because Robinhood's a low-cost provider, a lot of trades are free, then I'd say go for it and pay the $60 a year.
Another car question here from Jennifer in North Carolina. Clark, I have a car repair that is going to cost me $4,000.
No fun.
Whew. I have the money to pay for it, but it hurts to see that money leave my account. My credit union suggested a shared secure loan at 2.25% interest for up to 5 years. What are your thoughts on this? I should be able to pay off the loan in 3 to 4 months.
So if you're going to pay it off in 3 to 4 months, just take the money from savings, pay for it, and replenish the money in the 3 to 4 months. The reason you have money in savings is for the unexpected, for the oops. And to set up a loan and pay the credit union a spread of 2.25%, there's no reason to do so because you are in a position to replenish at a rate of like $1,000 a month. That's fantastic. Use the savings, rebuild it over the 3 or 4 months. You're good to go. This is a case where you want to keep it simple. Coming up ahead, housing costs, obviously, through the roof. But there's an old idea that has reemerged, and I'm going to share it with you, a way to actually have an affordable home.
Did you know the term financial advisor is utterly meaningless? Anyone can pretend to be one, including commissioned stockbrokers and insurance agents. Are you aware that even professionals trying to beat the market by picking stocks or timing have been shown on average to return less over time than index funds? Are you looking for a podcast that will give you sane, simple, consumer-centric advice about managing your money? I'm Don McDonald, and my co-host Tom and I invite you to listen to Talking Real Money on this and every podcast service. We promise to tell you the hard truths about money and investing because the truth will set you free to build a better future. We advocate for investors, not the financial industry. Plus, we think you'll be entertained in the process. Make Talking Real Money your source of fiscal truth. When you're finished with this podcast, just search for Talking Real Money. You have almost nothing to lose and a secure financial future to possibly gain. Visit TalkingRealMoney.com or search for Talking Real Money.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on credit worthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
It's funny how over the years, it's come up again and again how Sears, the first half of the 1900s, all the way up to, I think, after World War II or right around World War II, sold a home kit. And the home kit was one that was literally what it said. You'd order from the Sears catalog a home plan, of which they had many different home plans available, and they would send you all the parts to build your home, plus the plans. And these homes were very, very popular in rural America. And I'm sure around the country, there are still these homes standing that people don't even realize when they drive through an older area that it's one of these kit homes that people built from the plans that Sears sent them. If you're not familiar with Sears, it's a company that used to be the world's largest retailer. They got into every facet of life. They had a catalog, and you would literally do mail order of whatever you were buying. And Amazon actually, when Bezos was developing Amazon, apparently his model was the Sears catalog fast forwarded into modern times based on the internet. Well, housing costs, when you'd order a house from Sears, it'd be a few thousand dollars. In today's dollars, quite a bit more, but still very affordable. And Home Depot, starting in May, is going to be selling a two-bedroom home that is the same kind of idea. Home Depot will ship you, you buy the home from them. It's not going to be a few thousand dollars. It's going to be 60 grand. But the home will come with all the materials. and the plan to build it. Now, this will have a couple of different uses. One, there's a term that is used frequently but not truly known in popular culture called ADU, accessory dwelling unit, where let's say somebody has an aging relative and they're going to move them with them onto their property. They might build a cottage, known now in the lingo of land development and planning, is an accessory dwelling unit, ADU. And they might buy one, of which many, many, many are available. I did a thing on TV and the stations that carry me. I did a special on buying a home kit or buying an accessory dwelling unit and how the math works, and that if it's allowed where you live, the incredible financial benefit if it's something you rent out. The costs, you already have the land, you put it in, and the return on investment is so much better than a freestanding rental property. But the marketplace is looking for affordable answers. And these small two bedrooms that if you have a piece of land in an exurban area or rural area, or on your property in an urban or suburban area, you're allowed to put an accessory dwelling unit. This solves a lot of housing issues. When you think about what a renovation or addition of a kitchen or bathroom is in your existing home, that you could potentially have an entire home, small one, but have one for kind of the same price, is really significant. And I know what will happen next. There will be installation companies that pop up that will come in the marketplace for people who are not handy, who will buy one of these kits and build it for you. Pay a lot more for the construction, but they'll do that. But people who are handy will be able to build an affordable property, an affordable home. And this is such a positive step in the right direction. You know, housing got so big in the United States. I talked about this probably 6 months ago, that the average size of a house today is double. New construction is more than double what it was two generations ago in the U.S., and 50% larger than it was one generation ago in the United States. But the number of people living in that house is a tiny fraction today of what it used to be. So we're living in these big, big, big dwellings that cost more to maintain, more for utilities, all those things. And this is part of, I'd call it a simplicity movement, of building more affordable housing that is more manageable, cheaper to build, cheaper to own, and cheaper to repair and pay utilities on. And so this is another step in my mind in the right direction at a time that housing costs and interest rates have obviously gone in the wrong direction. And this brings something up, Krista, I have not mentioned to you. I've been doing my crazy kind of thinking about a way to fix the housing market. Mm-hmm. And it's way out there, and I've not heard this anywhere in an episode soon.
What?
I want to throw out.
You're not going to tell us?
No, I want to, because it's going to take some time. I want to throw out my whole mad professor kind of thing. Because I've been dwelling on this, thinking about this, and I have something that's so out there, it's going to be mind-blowing.
We'll do it tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
Yep. Okay, I'll go to questions now.
Okay.
And ironically, this one's from Buying a Crib in Texas. We are trying to buy a house with cash. I'm allergic to debt. And we are trying to pull together about $200,000 and are wondering what would be the best way to scrounge up the cash from the below options. One, remove it from an 18-month CD due to mature in October, earning 4.48% interest. Two, temporarily pull out of the index funds in an investment account, not retirement. This would be temporary because in a few months we'd be able to replace it, I assume with the CD money, right? And right. Or three, take out a TSP loan. I shudder typing that, but my spouse wants to include it.
So it could be a combination of the three, by the way. Let's talk about the CD. So you're going to forfeit 90 days interest. So your effective 4.48 isn't 4.48 anymore. It would have the least consequences potentially financially to do that. Second, you pull the money out of the index funds, you're then going to owe capital gains tax, depending on your income level. Capital gains tax could be, 15% or so, or I say or so, depending on your income level. And taking out the TSP loan, that would be inexpensive to do that. I don't like loans from retirement plans. But you know, it's funny in your case, since the CD is going to be available in 5 months and you could pay off the TSP loan at that point. I can't believe I'm going to say this, since you would only need the money for 5 months. Maybe your spouse is right. And the least consequential action, I don't know what it costs to take out the TSP loan in terms of origination fees for that, but you want to compare what that would be versus doing a early redemption of the CD. Compare what the cost is of each of those. And I would say 1 in 3 are actually my favorite options versus you touching the index funds. Even though the CD carries a higher rate of taxation because the interest you've earned on it is taxed at ordinary income tax rates, and the index fund is taxed at long-term capital gains rates, I like that money in the index funds to be for long-term growth. So it would be my least favorite. Now, the reason I could be wrong even on the second option, that's why there's no perfect answer here, is the stock market's had an enormous run-up. And you've seen enormous gains in those index funds over the last many years. So if you were to sell those, suffer the tax, use the money, you can sleep easy at night and know you can rebuild those funds with dollar cost averaging over time, putting them in. So there's actually a case to be made for each of the three scenarios, but I really stick with 1 in 3, with 3 being only for 5 months or whatever point you find the house you want. Then you replenish, pay off that TSP loan with the money when the CD matures in the fall.
Julia, Massachusetts writes, Mr. Howard advised his viewers,
who?
I know, I think she's just trying to be polite, advised his viewers to obtain a home equity line always from a credit union because they're cheaper. This is simply not true. He completely ignores community banks who are very competitive and, in the case of my bank, lowered than the two local credit unions for home equity loans. I understand credit unions are often lower, but he was emphatic. This information can hurt a consumer. Thanks for listening.
Julie, you're right. You know, I used to talk so much about community banks, and the problem is there are so few left. After the banking scandals, the federal government bailed out big and regional banks and let the independently owned 1-2 office local banks shutter. They didn't save them when they saved the bigs. So what's happened is there are a lot of what appear to be local banks that appear to be community banks that are actually owned by bigger players, and they're pretending to be community banks. So that's why community banks aren't in my vocabulary as much as they used to be, because there were thousands of them 15 years ago. So you're right. I should mention that. I should mention the annex. You got to make sure it's a real local bank. And that is a sin of omission on my part that I only say credit union.
Frank in Florida says, my wife and I booked a 2-week cruise for last April. We had to cancel for medical reasons, yet despite having canceled for any reason coverage, our trip insurance denied our claim. Here are the details. I purchased trip insurance coverage, which included the cancel for any reason. The trip was over $2,000, yet when I canceled in advance, I was denied, claiming they don't cover any cruise credits that were applied. Here's the policy buried in the fine print, which is ambiguous at best. Payments for or deposits means the cash, check, or credit amounts actually paid for your travel arrangements. Certificates, vouchers, discounts, and or credits applied in part or full toward the cost of your travel arrangements are not payments or deposits as defined herein. Please warn your viewers not to use travel insurance if using future cruise credits for payment, something I wish I'd known in advance.
FCCs are a term that was invented during COVID when cruise lines shut down. And FCCs have had more bad wrinkles than you could think of. So an FCC is kind of like, it became like a gift certificate, a future cruise credit. Cruise lines shut down. They couldn't afford to give people refunds. even though they're based in the U.S., they're not U.S. corporations, which is why Congress gave them no bailout like they gave the airlines. And so the cruise line said, yeah, well, we're not going to give you your money back. But here's an FCC, a future cruise credit, that became like a voucher you could use for a period of time. So the insurance providers were like, wait a minute. People are going to book cruises, and then they're going to make a claim as a way to get the money back they couldn't get otherwise. So they all put in these provisions in the trip policies that even cancel for any reason stuff was not covered if the money was a future cruise credit. It is a terrible wrinkle, but there is an odd angle that I wanted to bring your way. If you had on that original cruise back during COVID, if you had trip insurance on that cruise, your claim for money from the future cruise credit when you couldn't go because of a medical problem, as I have read, your claim goes against the trip insurance from the original cruise, not the rebook cruise using the future cruise credit. If you had no insurance on the original cruise, I'm sad to say, I think that money's gone just as the insurance company said. Is it fair? Nothing about the future cruise credit system was fair. And this is an odd after effect of it that is a terrible thing. And I just hated that the cruise lines basically got away with not giving people refunds at most cruise lines when the cruise lines shut down.
All right. We've got a Clarkie today. If you want to leave a Clarkie, you call 404-981-2071. And that number is in our show notes daily as well. So here is Sarah.
Hi, Clark. My name is Sarah. I just wanted to let you know that last year I racked up about $20,000 in credit card debt, much to my husband's dismay. He's a power budgeter and he listens. He's been listening to you for quite some time. I was pretty resistant to podcasts with budgeting, but he started to play your podcast in the car while we were together. And needless to say, I learned a lot. I want to thank you for not making me feel guilty about my credit card debt, because I was already feeling very guilty anyway. I know there are many people out there like me who have credit card debt. You are inspiring and helped me to realize the importance of not having credit card debt. So I am so happy to report that through much hard work, planning, and budgeting, the credit cards are paid off as of today.
Oh, congratulations.
So good. We have a plan for no more credit card debt, and I plan to follow it to a T. Thanks for all of your encouragement and knowledge in all of your podcasts. You rock.
Wow. No, you rock, because you heard it and you took it to heart and you did what you had to. And the sacrifices involved, that credit card debt is gone, all because of you.
Way to go, Sarah.
Sarah, I am so impressed, and congratulations for doing it. And, you know, you can pick up advice anywhere. It's what you do with the advice that matters. You grabbed it and you took that credit card debt down. You wrestled it to the ground and paid it off. And that is fantastic. If you have a Clarkie you'd like to leave, call 404-981-2071. Remember what we're about, that you learn ways to save more, spend less, and avoid getting ripped off. Have a great day.